Hi everyone, Benjamin here. Welcome to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. In 1846, a Hungarian physician named Ignaz Semmelweis was working in the maternity clinic at Vienna's General Hospital. At the time, a large proportion of women died during childbirth from a disease known as childbed fever. In some hospitals, the death rate was so high that women actually had a better chance of surviving if they gave birth in the street. But it wasn't like this everywhere. Semmelweis noticed that midwives delivering babies in people's homes had a much higher success rate. And even within his own hospital there were differences. One of the clinics, called the First Clinic, was staffed by men and lost around 1 in 10 women to childbed fever. But the second clinic, which was staffed by women, had a mortality rate that was 3 times lower. Why was this? Semmelweis investigated various different theories. He observed that in the first clinic, women were delivered lying on their backs, while in the second, they lay on their sides. But when he tested the different methods, neither had an impact on mortality. Another theory was that priests who came to deliver the last rites to dying women terrified the other patients with their appearance and the ringing of a bell. In the first clinic, the priests had to walk through several wards to get to the sick room, whereas in the second clinic, they could reach the sick room directly. But here again, changing the routes of the priests made no difference to death rates in the clinics. Eventually, Semmelweis hit upon the answer. Male staff from the first clinic were training to be doctors, and often began their day performing autopsies. This they did without wearing gloves or washing their hands before heading straight to the maternity ward to deliver newborns. Here's an extract from the book that Semmelweis eventually published on his findings. Because of the anatomical orientation of the Viennese medical school, professors, assistants, and students had frequent opportunity to contact cadavers. In the examination of pregnant or delivering maternity patients, the hands, contaminated with cadaverous particles, are brought into contact with the genitals of these individuals, creating the possibility of reabsorption. Midwives in the second clinic, who hadn't spent the day rooting around inside corpses, were therefore much less likely to transfer these particles to the birth canals of pregnant women. We now know that childbed fever is usually caused by a bacterium, Streptococcus pyogenes. But Semmelweis had no such explanation for what these cadaverous particles might be. The concept of germs and pathogens wouldn't arise until years later, when Louis Pasteur would perform his famous experiments and provide proof for the germ theory of disease. Nevertheless, Semmelweis's solution was that doctors wash their hands in chlorinated lime to remove the cadaverous smell from their hands. Chlorine is also a powerful disinfectant, and lo and behold, after introducing these measures, the deaths from childbed fever in both clinics dropped below 1%, and in some months, not a single patient died. Unfortunately, to say that Semmelweis's ideas about hand washing weren't universally accepted would be something of an understatement. In fact, they were met with fierce resistance and criticism. At the time of his death in an asylum in 1865, when he was just 47 years old, the medical and scientific community were still largely opposed to the idea that doctors could somehow be responsible for the deaths of their own patients. Of course, today we know that this isn't the case, and although far too late, Semmelweis has finally got the credit he deserves. 170 years later, hand washing is recognised as a vital part of modern healthcare. Sadly though, we far from fixed the problem that Semmelweis faced back in the mid-1800s. Each year, hundreds of millions of people around the world develop healthcare-associated infections, which cause unnecessary deaths and suffering and huge financial losses. According to the World Health Organization, out of all the people that are hospitalized any given time, 7 to 10% will go on to develop a healthcare-associated infection. So what can we do to reduce that burden?
More than 20 years ago, we described the fact that promoting hand hygiene using a system to change the behavior could be a way to save and prevent many infections and even save lives.
This is Professor Didier Pittet. Since 2005, Didier has worked with the WHO on a global healthcare campaign called Clean Care is Safer Care. The campaign addresses many things, but at its center is the promotion of hand hygiene.
We develop tools in order to change behavior and make sure that hospitals would adhere to a better hand hygiene activities, ultimately with the goal of saving lives. There was actually several problems, and before we started to actually provide solutions, we did a lot of research on the reason why nurses and doctors had problems to actually wash their hands. And currently today, when we say wash your hands, we understand that you use soap and water, whether the soap is medicated or not, to wash your hands. But what we realized at time and already published was that actually nurses and doctors technically had no time to wash hands. If you take the example of a nurse in the ICU, she would have to actually wash hands more than 20 times every hour of patient care. And when you realize what washing hands means, going time to go to the sink, turn on the water, actually have water on your hands, wash your hands with soap, then rinse your hands, then dry your hands, then go back to your patient, it takes between 1 and 1.5 minutes. We actually timed it in critical care, for example. And when you multiply this more than 20 times an hour by 1 to 1.5 minutes, you got the results. And that's very easy to understand. Nurses and doctors simply had no time to wash their hands. That's the reason why we actually propose what is called today a system change. We changed the system. We recommended to use alcohol, so alcohol-based hand rubs or alcohol-based hand sanitizer in order to clean hands or to perform hand hygiene as frequently as possible and as good as possible, because alcohol can be made immediately available at the point of patient care. It is very effective. There is no resistance to alcohol, and it's much better tolerated than soap and water. And that was a major system change that we introduced.
Like any large-scale system change, there were issues. For example, Didier says it took them 2 years just to show that alcohol hand sanitizers wouldn't be a significant fire hazard. And there were other problems too.
We had situations where actually alcohol is alcohol. There are two forms of alcohol. One is isopropyl alcohol. Another is ethyl alcohol. And in some countries where the production started where people were actually discovering this ethyl-based alcohol, they also realized that they could actually use it and derive it to drink it. And it was another problem that we had, and we had to find a way using some chemical addition to make it undrinkable. And we added dimethyl ketone in some instances in order to make sure people would not actually use this alcohol for other reasons than the reason why we actually introduced the alcohol.
While they were dealing with people who wanted to drink the hand wash supplies, the campaign also faced the opposite problem. People who were trying to avoid consuming alcohol for religious reasons.
We had Muslim healthcare workers at the very beginning of the campaign who actually were a little reluctant to apply alcohol on their hands, being afraid of the possible absorption through the skin of a substance that actually is prohibited by the Quran. You and I both know very well that Muslims cannot drink alcohol. But what is not very clear is how much could Muslims absorb alcohol, even a very teeny quantity of alcohol. When we had this situation, we also had the report of some events. And one of the events was a Muslim healthcare worker working in the UK for more than 6 months, applying alcohol on her hands every day at work and still living at her father's place. When the father understood that she was applying alcohol on her hands every day, actually he evicted her from home. That was really something, as you can say, an incident or an accident. That was for us a reason to endorse the problem from the very, very beginning and from the racine, as we say, of the problem. So what we did, we went to Saudi Arabia. We worked with the Muslim clergy and Muslim scholars in Riyadh, in Saudi Arabia. And we actually went through all the verses of the Quran that were addressing alcohol. And we obtained, at the end, a fatwa. We went to the Muslim League with all the argument for the good of using alcohol during patient care, and we obtained a fatwa. And today, the use of alcohol-based hand rub is largely accepted by the Muslim League, but also by healthcare workers on the ground. Because when you look at Muslim countries, these are among the countries where the initiative is the most impressive around the world. So because of this cultural background, we had to actually endorse the problem and to find a solution to the problem. And we were very happy to find this solution.
One of the other big challenges for the project was that in many parts of the world, alcohol isn't readily or cheaply available as a resource for making hand sanitizer. So the team had to come up with their own solution to provide people with it.
So what we did is actually in the context of the WHO strategy, we had pilot sites, and one of our pilot sites was in Mali in Africa. What we did, we developed the recipe and the way to produce an alcohol-based hand rub locally. So in other words, in Mali, but then in other places in Africa, what we did is we started from sugar cane. You take sugar, and they have a lot of sugar, sugar cane in Mali. You take the sugar cane, you squeeze the sugar cane to produce the sugar, and with the leftover, you can, of course, produce alcohol. And it was not only a recipe that we gave, but the formulation that we proposed that was originally actually created at the University of Geneva. We gave this formulation license-free to WHO, and we also gave the recipe how to produce this formulation. And nowadays, alcohol-based hand rub is produced locally in more than 50 countries around the world, starting from sugarcane, from maize, manioc, walnut, rice, and potatoes at very low cost, which make it easier or at least possible for those resource-limited hospitals to start the system change. And that's so important because without this system change, which is to say replacing soap and water hand washing by alcohol-based hand rubbing, it's very, very difficult, if even possible, to succeed with this multimodal strategy to improve hand hygiene.
Didier says that this last example is proof that even in resource-limited places, it's possible to make a difference with their strategy and improve patient outcomes. One of the places that has really stuck with him is a maternity hospital in Vietnam.
One of the most rewarding time was these hospitals in Vietnam where we helped implementing the strategy. Let me give you a few insight about the hospital. It's the largest mother-child hospital in the entire Indochina Peninsula. This hospital is delivering more than 55,000 babies a year, which is huge. You know, in my hospital, my own hospital in Geneva, which is the largest delivery hospital in Switzerland, we are delivering 5,000 babies a year. So we are talking at more than 10 times more there. Now, there, what we could do with a little bit of money is to help them to monitor infections. They had no monitoring system for infections. So we installed the system. It took 3 years to do it very well. And after 3 years, we were very confident with the quality of the data. Speaking of healthcare-associated infection, the healthcare-associated infection rates were relatively high, not very, very high, but relatively high, like in the range of twice to three times what we see in our regions in the westernized medicine system. And actually, we implemented the strategy in this hospital. We helped them to implement the strategy, but mostly they did it by themselves, just by some using some of our direction. They really implemented the strategy. 5 years later, When I visited the hospital, I had the privilege to see the data for the very first time. Guess what? The infection rates was reduced by 80% year by year. We reduced by 80% the infection rates. And together with these, I could see the maternal mortality and the children mortality rates reduced by an equal 80%. And these, when you see that, it's unbelievable. And I had tears in my eyes at that time. So I thought, well, okay, we did it. They did it. They understood how to do it. And now this hospital is a Hand Hygiene Excellence Award hospital. And he's really carrying with this hospital the entire country. And we are talking about the population that has suffered from war for years. And now it's coming up. It's popping up all directions. So they need a really good healthcare system in order to sustain the growth of this country, the growth of this population that deserve it. So, yes, this is a very moving time.
From a maternity clinic in Vienna in the 1800s to a maternity hospital in Vietnam today, attitudes towards hand hygiene have certainly changed. But a shift in attitude isn't enough. A shift in behaviour is needed to really have an impact. I asked Didier what difference the campaign has made.
The estimates are that there is 500,000 patients worldwide getting healthcare-associated infection every day, and that over a year there will be millions of people dying of healthcare-associated infections worldwide. The estimates are that with the strategy you can reduce these infections by half, and the current estimates are that the campaign is saving several million lives every year. So the most important is to make sure that we can reach as many hospitals and as many healthcare settings as possible. What I like very much is this campaign was not only made of many different instruments that were developed by the world experts in hand hygiene that I had the privilege to have with me at WHO, that WHO sustained the campaign. So all of that is a gift, you know. And nowadays, the most important is to make sure that we can sustain these, and that when you say sustaining it, it means that I hope that this work and the rewarding that we got from this work will stimulate others to continue and to do it even better than what we did until now, and that this work would help to what we call universal health coverage, because at the end of the story, everybody around the world needs and deserves the same good health system. We know that there will be always, or there are for many, many years to come, unbalances between and gaps between the different health systems. But at least this very simple action can be very significant and have a very, very meaningful impact on health. And so it comes into the universal health coverage that we all want for the future generations to come. So to me, if I can contribute to that together with my team, I would be pleased.
Well, that's it for this month, team. Thanks for listening. You can find out more about the work of Didier and his team at cleanhandssavelives.org. You can find out more about the Microbiology Society on our website, which is microbiologysociety.org. You can follow us on Twitter at microbiosoc, and we're on Facebook as well. We also have a blog. If you Google microbe post, you should be able to find that. Loads of good stuff on there. We've just started a big new series on emerging diseases, so you can learn about how rat control in Sierra Leone is being used to prevent Lassa fever, and you can learn about Xylella fastidiosa, a relatively obscure bacterium that is killing olive trees in Italy. As always, if you've enjoyed the podcast, it'd be so great if you could leave us a review or some stars on iTunes. Our show is edited and produced by Anand Jagatia. I've been Benjamin Thompson. See you all next month.